the first Commonwealth, Matthew A. Fitzgerald, Brian D. Smallpox, Travis C. Dunn, Charles L. Webb, Virginia Collins Council, Mark R. Marion, Attorney General, Toby J. Hyden, Solicitor General, Matthew R. McGuire, Principal Deputy Solicitor General, Victoria Pearson, Deputy Attorney General, Christopher D. Canada, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Travis Gunn, McGuire Woods, here on behalf of Appellant Ryan Collins. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Great.
Yes, sir. This Court should reverse the Court of Appeals. Officer Rose trespassed into the curtilage of Collins' home was unconstitutional because it was without a warrant. The sole issue remaining before this Court is whether Officer Rose's conduct was permitted by the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement. It was not, and on this record, there are 4 reasons why there was no exigency. No one was home. Number 2, Officer Rhodes was investigating past crimes that occurred months before. Number 3, before and after Officer Rhodes arrived at the Delmead Lane residence, he had the capability to apply for a warrant. And number 4, while at the Delmead Lane residence, and while a warrant was being applied for, Officer Rhodes could secure the scene and maintain the status quo. Taking all these points together, this record shows that there was no exigency supporting Officer Rhodes' warrantless trespass into the curtilage. On the first point, Officer Rhodes testified that there was no one home, and his testimony further displayed that he didn't have probable cause to believe that someone was at the home with immediate access to the motorcycle and with the motive to essentially commit another crime, to abscond with the motorcycle and obstruct justice.
But at the particular point in time that he was there, he had probable cause to believe that there had been a similar two previous events of high-speed eluding on the same motorcycle. Am I right?
Almost, Your Honor. He had probable cause to believe. We do no longer dispute at this stage in the proceedings that he had probable cause to believe that the motorcycle he saw in the driveway was the motorcycle involved in past eluding incidents.
So the defendant had already eluded police at over 100 miles an hour. So there's a history of this. You're not just walking up on a motorcycle and asking yourself, can someone rev it and go? It's already been revved and went.
Well, Your Honor, a couple of responses. Perhaps the most pertinent is just because the item in question had been used in an emergency situation in the past did not mean that that item is forever considered an emergency situation, no matter the other facts surrounding it.
Didn't Collins at that point know that the police were on him?
Well, Your Honor, Officer Rhodes admitted that he didn't have probable cause to think that Collins was the individual who had eluded police in the past. And to address your answer about what was happening at the DMV, we maintain that the circumstances that happened at the DMV did not give rise to an exigency. But if the court was concerned about what was happening at the DMV, that exigency was extinguished when Officer Rhodes and another officer, at least one other officer, arrived at the Delmead Lane residence. Because if there was some concern about getting to the Delmead Lane residence quickly, well, Officer Rhodes did so. It took him about 30 minutes, but he got there. And when he arrived on the scene, there was nobody else there. He and another officer stood around. They were in broad daylight. They saw no activity from the home, no signs of life, no one peeking from the curtains as there have been in other cases. And they took some photographs. And then he casually walked up the driveway and then trespassed in the curtilage. So while I appreciate the point that maybe the events at the DMV created a concern to get to the Delmead Lane residence, which we dispute, but maybe so. Once Officer Rhodes arrived, the exigency was extinguished. Officer Rhodes also testified that throughout this entire scenario, or his investigation was focused on these past crimes of eluding. This is not the circumstance of having an exigency where he needed to trespass into the curtilage to stop a crime that was about to occur. Officer Rhodes also had plenty of opportunity to get to a warrant. There were several officers that were accompanying him in his investigation, Officer Linton, Officer McCall. They were at his command. He also had other officers in his unit and also at the DMV. Any of these officers could have applied for a warrant on Officer Rhodes' behalf, or perhaps he had the ability to remotely apply for a warrant. And while he was doing so, there were common sense, everyday police tactics that he could use to secure the scene and maintain the status quo. So, for example, Officer Rose, when he came onto the scene, the motorcycle was parked in curtilage but in a dead end. It was surrounded by three sides by walls in the home, and so it needed to come down the driveway to be removed from the property.
Isn't that, though, where a motorcycle and a car are distinct? I can't drive my car anywhere on my property to get it out onto a road. It pretty much has to come down the driveway. Motorcycle has a little bit more flexibility. So how would you deal with that under this fact pattern?
So the point is well appreciated, Your Honor, but the curtilage is the area immediately adjacent to the home, and outside the curtilage is what the Fourth Amendment case is called open fields, and officers are allowed to essentially operate freely within open fields. So Officer Rose could have parked his car up the driveway, boxing in, maybe not completely, but up the driveway outside of curtilage in open fields, helping box in the motorcycle and also dissuading anyone from even attempting, even thinking that it might be possible to uncover the motorcycle, jam the key in while officers are there watching what is happening. Additionally, Officer Rose had the capability.
If there wasn't exigent circumstances at the instant that he is either on the property in open fields or immediately off the property, but he sees someone coming towards the motorcycle, apparently intending to drive it, does that create an exigency where he could then come onto the curtilage to stop it from being driven?
I think the answer is there is a closer question of exigency if the officers are seeing an individual running towards the motorcycle. For sure.
We're walking towards the motorcycle.
When there's walking towards the motorcycle, there is a close question there, but officers are having other strategies. The officers can stop and talk to this individual. If they want to say, hey, where are you going, and the individual keeps walking, I think we certainly have an exigent circumstance. It appears this individual is going to try to flee. But if the individual, this is at a home, and people just live at home, and the mere presence of an individual plus the object in question does not create an exigent circumstance at the home. And the fact that he might be traveling towards the motorcycle does not, in and of itself, create an exigency. But if there are other indicators that he is trying to get onto the motorcycle, specifically to flee, to hide the motorcycle, we are certainly in the realm of exigent circumstances.
What about, are you familiar with the Bims case?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it seems to me that that's factually and legally analogous to this case. Now, on the exigent circumstance issue, obviously the automobile exception issue, we don't need to talk about. But
so, Your Honor, a couple things. First, as a preliminary matter for FIMS, to the extent we're talking about it in the good faith exception realm, the Commonwealth has waived that remedies argument. But as to the merits of the issue, like did FIMS essentially excuse what happened here, it did not, because FIMS was, at the beginning and the end of the day, about the automobile exception applied to automobiles either in public or on private property that was held open to the public, so not on curtilage.
But I don't know why that, I saw that in your brief, I just don't know why conceptually that matters with respect to exigent circumstances, because exigent circumstances cuts through the curtilage, cuts through the front door, cuts through everything. The question of the scope of privacy is not relevant because it has the power to cut through all of those exceptions.
So the reason why is because the exigent circumstances analysis within TIMS is encompassed within the, it is an outdated part of the automobile exception.
Well, you know, but isn't it just natural that the automobile exception, curtilage or not, was based upon the idea of mobility and how easy it is to drive a car away? So, I mean, I don't know why we would strip that concept out of exigent circumstances just because it doesn't now apply in the curtilage.
We are not saying that the mobility of the object can never come into play in the exigent circumstances analysis, but it is merely one of several other factors to consider within the context of the case.
Okay.
TIMS is not factually analogous because a reasonable understanding of TIMS is not that just because you see a motorcycle, you can then jump into the side window to search a motorcycle that's inside.
Right, of course, but as you'll hear in just about 5 minutes, that's not the only thing that's in this case. We have two high-speed eluding by someone who apparently has a distinct appearance and this particular motorcycle appears to be exactly that, and that someone that they think is the person is onto it and realizes that he's being followed and being questioned by police, that's just a very different circumstance than just walking up on a motorcycle, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, in the extent of what was actually happening on the ground at the Delmead Lane residence. To the extent there was any concern about somebody approaching the motorcycle, the fact of the matter of the record on this case is that Officer Rhodes arrived and the only people there were police officers, Officer Rhodes and Officer Litton. And so if there was some concern of another individual that might want to try to access the motorcycle, that concern did not manifest in any way that would give rise to a probable cause concern to establish exigency. And I note that I tried looking for cases, and I know the Commonwealth has as well, trying to find cases where the only people on the scene were police officers, and there's still an exigent circumstance regard to destroying the physical evidence. So this isn't like data or anything like that, physical evidence on the scene. And I did not find any. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I certainly have not found any to supply the court with that authority to even try to fight against it.
Is there a factual contest as to, you know, what the officers actually knew about who was present or not present? I mean, as everyone has acknowledged, the trial court did not actually make factual findings on exigent circumstances because of the holding was predicated on different ground. But it's before us now. It was raised by both parties below, raised in the Court of Appeals, decided by the Court of Appeals, raised in our court. That's not decided by us, but in your best case scenario, I don't understand why, even if you had a winning argument, why the argument would not only result in a remand for these factual inferences to be addressed by the fact finder as opposed to by appellate judges.
Because we are in the realm of alternative grounds, Your Honor, and this court has explained that alternative grounds are available to appellees only when the record as it exists. The Commonwealth already had its opportunity to create the record it could use on appeal. And this court has said appellees of any stripe, not just the Commonwealth, get to use the record that they helped create, but they don't get a second bite at the apple once they realize the arguments they wanted to put forward in the trial court don't quite win the day on appeal.
But exigent circumstances was appealed to us from the holding of the Court of Appeals and the assignments of error in our case was not that exigent circumstances should have been addressed at all because it was a right result, wrong reason, inapplicability, but it was addressed on the merits. And so I don't know that the point you're making wasn't given up already by two sets of briefs, one's in the Court of Appeals and one in the Supreme Court of Virginia. Do you see what I'm saying? The idea that you can't raise this argument of exigent circumstances was long since gone when the Court of Appeals was briefed on it, and argued on it, ruled on it, and then appealed to us on it.
Your Honor, it's not our position that the Commonwealth cannot argue exigent circumstances based off of the record that exists.
Okay.
We are saying that they have to take the record as it comes, and to affirm on alternative grounds that Commonwealth has to show that the record supports its heavy burden to show that exigent circumstances existed. Because the reason why there is a dispute about do they have a heavy burden, but they don't get to circumvent the trial process and get all the usual benefits of an appellee for this alternative grounds that no trial court, no fact finder decided the facts that would support the judgment of exigent circumstances. So they don't get to skip that trial phase, which if they were successful in exigent circumstances in the trial court, certainly this court as an appellate court would draw all the inferences in their favor, but that's because a trial actually happens and a fact finder actually makes factual findings.
But why wouldn't then that be your best argument? That if there are inferences that need to be weighed and burdens of proof that need to be considered, it should be decided in the first instance by the court of first review, not the court of last review. And then we would review it on grounds of whatever. I mean, for all we know, the trial court could say, you know, I'm not sure I believe the officer when he said X or Y or Z. And it may be a critical fact that we're talking about today.
So, Your Honor, it is certainly an argument we have made about the standard of review and how we're in the world of alternative grounds. And to the extent that the record does not support, to the extent there are gaps in the record, to the extent that there are factual inferences that are conflicting, the Commonwealth cannot benefit from alternative grounds that require resolving those facts. And this court has said that time and again in cases such as Banks, Whitehead, and Perry, I believe. I have 30 seconds left, so I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and well, good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Matt McGuire on behalf of the Commonwealth. As you just heard, the case returns to this Court on remand from the United States Supreme Court, but we disagree at the outset with what the scope of the remand is. Although the U.S. Supreme Court did explicitly say that this Court could consider exigent circumstances on remand, and that is an argument that we have advanced in our briefs, the Court also said, directed this Court to take actions, quote, not inconsistent with their opinion. So our view remains there are two avenues on which this Court should affirm the Court of Appeals. The easiest and most straightforward way to do so would be to resolve the case using the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, and so you would hold that even if there were a Fourth Amendment violation in this case for the reasons given by the United States Supreme Court, the exclusionary rule doesn't apply here, so you wouldn't suppress the evidence. Of course, the second point is what the Court has spent most of the afternoon so far talking about with my friend on the other side about whether exigent circumstances justified the search here. We certainly think that they do, but I would like to focus most of my time this morning on the exclusionary rule point, which we do think provides the easiest way out of this case and has frequently been the way courts have handled remands in Fourth Amendment cases in recent times. And the reason why is the exclusionary rule.
Before you go any further, is it good faith circumstances before us because Justice Thomas raised it, or has it ever been before us before by the Commonwealth?
So, Your Honor, I think the answer is both things in part. The reason why is Justice Thomas did raise it, and so you can see that in his concurrence on page 1 notes that there's a suppression issue open in this case. And the second is sort of the unique nature of the Davis line of good faith cases. Under Davis, and what my argument is this morning, is you look at whether officers acted objectively in good faith based on existing appellate precedent. So for the Commonwealth to raise that argument before a situation like this one, the argument would go something like, on the theory that the court changes dramatically the holdings that we think apply, you shouldn't suppress the evidence because the officers acted in good faith. You have to presuppose the outcome here. And so we don't think that we should have to raise that as a threshold matter in every case going forward. If we lose the Fourth Amendment argument, the court should say, well, it's a departure from past practice, so the exclusionary rule doesn't apply.
Was there any testimony from the officer about good faith at the trial, or are we simply supposed to imply from the record that he may have had good faith because he may have heard about Thames at the academy, and that may have been in his mind while he was standing there?
Your Honor, what you look at is the objectively reasonable officer. It's not specific to Officer Rhodes here. You just
but
say
here we have no, we can't bolster it at all with any testimony from him.
Well, there's
you
no
have to simply assume the objective reasonable officer. We're not looking at this specific officer. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice Sims. You're looking at the objectively reasonable officer, so testimony from Officer Rhodes on the point isn't necessary. And this court hasn't addressed the good faith exception, I don't believe, under the exclusionary rule after Davis came out in 2011, and we think this would be a good case to do so. And the reason why is, as I said, the test from Davis is whether the police officers, quote, conduct a search in objectively reasonable reliance on binding judicial precedent.
You may have answered this, but opposing counsel says you've waived the good faith exception argument, and I think the Chief Justice's question was proceeding along that same path. Tell me why you haven't waived it.
Your Honor, again, it goes to sort of the unique nature of how the Davis good faith exception comes up. So more recently, what we've seen is Leon sort of good faith arguments. There's a defect in the warrant, which people might know about in advance, and so you say the officer acted in good faith on a defective warrant. There's no reason to exclude that evidence or suppress the evidence. Davis good faith comes up only where there's binding judicial precedent that would support the officer's action in the case, and we think there are three such precedents here. And so when you have the Davis argument come up is when those precedents change, the legal landscape changes. And so you've most recently seen it in connection with Jones, the GPS case. You've seen it from the Court of Appeals, actually, very recently in connection with Carpenter. There was a case on the CSLI data that was decided a couple weeks ago on that ground. And you saw it in Byrd, the case we cited in our brief, which was argued at the same time as Collins, which notably the remand order when you're dealing with federal courts is different. federal courts of appeals are instructed to take actions consistent with United States Supreme Court opinion generally. And in Byrd, the Third Circuit said, we're not going to exclude the evidence. And if you go look at the briefing before the United States Supreme Court, the federal government did not raise an exclusionary rule argument at that time either. So we think it's just properly comes up now, just given the way the Davis good faith exception works. And there's no obligation on the Commonwealth to brief it in every case on a hypothetical set of facts.
Well, why is this any different than the posture you were in when you came from the Court of Appeals to us before? I mean, Davis came out in 2011, yet when you appealed this, when you were defending this case before us before, you didn't raise Davis, so why are you doing it now?
Well, Justice Goodwin, the Court of Appeals dropped a footnote signaling that it wasn't going to apply the automobile exception there, but I wouldn't call that a holding of the court. It said we can never do it, just said they thought the facts and circumstances were different. This court disagreed expressly on the record and did hold that the automobile exception authorized the search, which was the Commonwealth's principal argument all throughout this case. We defended that to the United States Supreme Court on the merits, where we lost. And now that we're back, our position is that there are three clear lines of precedent that made Officer Rhodes' conduct objectively reasonable here. The first being the automobile exception itself, which this court had pointed out, had never before been limited until the United States Supreme Court in this case. The court quoted Maryland versus Dyson for that point, and we think that sentence stands for the point. If a car is readily mobile and probable cause exists to believe it contains contraband, the Fourth Amendment permits police to search the vehicle without more. That's how this court explained the automobile exception. Assuming an objectively reasonable officer understood the law the way this court did, that would have supported the search. The second case would be Timms itself, which is factually indistinguishable from this one for the reasons Justice McClanahan pointed out.
Okay. Where in Timms can I find that the car was in the curtilage? If you can, I've got Timms in front of me. Tell me where the language is.
So, Your Honor, the best place to look for it is in the dissent itself, I believe. I'll give you the exact page number. The closest that the curtilage actually comes up is on the VA 94 of the dissent, Justice Poff's dissent. It points out that on brief, the Commonwealth concedes that the Thunderbird was found, quote, in a protected zone of privacy. So our position would be that that does not actually say the word curtilage, but that is, in fact, what the curtilage is.
Well, the irony is all seven of us accepted the idea that if, in fact, the only issue were the search of the motorcycle, that it would have been appropriate. None of us said, as best I can recall, that the curtilage doctrine was the dispositive point. So the law in Virginia, until it was reversed by the Supreme Court, was pretty clear.
That's right, Justice Kelsey. I read the opinions the same way. I didn't read this court to hang on the curtilage. I didn't read Justice Mims' dissent to say that either. But
at the time, it didn't. Counsel, my question is not going to be quite as friendly as Justice Kelsey's. You read part of the quote from Justice Poff. The remainder is in the parentheses, located in a driveway of private property, which leads to my next question. Are you making the argument that the entire driveway of any private property is curtilage?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying...
So Justice Poff was saying that the driveway was a protected zone. That may or may not be the case for the entire driveway. In this case, we know that the U.S. Supreme Court believes that the portion of the driveway where the motorcycle was parked was curtilage. The Supreme Court has told us that. But we have nothing that is that certain in the Timms case. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, again, because what Justice Pomp is talking about is a concession of the Commonwealth. I agree with you about it. It says located in a driveway of private property is good for us.
The Commonwealth has conceded it was in a driveway is one way to look at it.
What he's quoting the Commonwealth's brief is also saying in a protected zone of privacy. The Commonwealth agreed that you had a privacy interest there?
You have a privacy in a driveway is the bottom line. We don't know exactly where in the driveway. You may be correct.
Your Honor, so let me take a step back and try to answer your question this way. Even if we can disagree amongst ourselves here about what TIM stands for, maybe there's some factually minor differences, or maybe legally the curtilage determination matters.
There are some factual differences, but you made the point that it was factually indistinguishable, and I couldn't see where it was factually indistinguishable.
I'm sorry if I wasn't clear enough, Justice Mims. What I meant was factually indistinguishable from the perspective of an objectively reasonable police officer. Let me tell you why.
Let me ask you one other distinction, if I may. I don't want to take up too much of your time with it. In Timms, the automobile was in plain view and did not have license plates. In this instance, the motorcycle was covered by a tarp. There is a factual distinction. Is it legally significant?
Your Honor, I think from the previous, when this case came up previously, when our position has been all along, Officer Rhodes testified that he could recognize the exact same motorcycle based on the Facebook photos and based on the silhouette underneath the cover, based on the fact.
And why did he have to lift the tarp in the first place?
Because he was trying to confirm what the VIN number was on the motorcycle because they had suspected that it was also stolen. That was sort of part of his procedure. So, but I do think that the way to read Timms is at a much higher level, Your Honor.
He had problems. Did he have probable cause to make an arrest without lifting the tarp based upon the eluding, independent of whether it was stolen or not?
Your Honor, I don't believe we have taken that position. I don't think Officer Rhodes ever said that before the trial court.
But that's the position, that's where your argument eventually rests, that he must have had probable cause to make the arrest without lifting the tarp if, in fact, he was certain that that was the motorcycle.
Your Honor, he was certain that it was the motorcycle, that he was less certain. The issue on the eluding side was not the presence of the motorcycle. It was whether or not it was affirmatively Mr. Collins. If there's any doubt on the eluding, it was exclusively that. But I do really want to return to Timms.
But here, you just made the argument that the reason he lifted the tarp was to see the VIN. And the reason he wanted to see the VIN was because he thought it was stolen. You also said that he didn't need to lift the tarp to see if it was the same motorcycle, because you said he was certain it was the same motorcycle. And so, which led me to ask, did he have probable cause to make an arrest for the eluding based upon the fact that he was certain that was the motorcycle?
Your Honor, my understanding of the record in this case is that there were gaps, slight gaps, before the search on both sides. One, I believe Officer Rhodes testified to it, or the record suggests, that he didn't feel that he had enough probable cause to arrest Mr. Collins on the eluding piece, that he did, that was identification related. But with respect to the stolen motorcycle, the record is a little bit even harder to fully understand the time frame on this. But he had learned from Eric Jones that that motorcycle likely had been stolen because it didn't have a title. But they didn't yet have the VIN for it. And so he went up the driveway on that side to figure out if the bike was in fact stolen. He just had probable cause maybe to think that it was, but he didn't know. So they're just two separate
did
gaps
here. Did he lift
here.
The tarp only enough to see the VIN, or did he lift it beyond that?
Your Honor, he took the tarp off, but he recovered it. But I do want to return to your initial question, because I do think it's important. From the perspective of the objectively reasonable officer, we think Timms stands for this. The officer saw a car in a driveway that he believed was stolen, and it was also the fruit of a crime, same situation. He walked up the driveway, he opened the door, he searched the VIN. That is exactly what happened here, so we think, as an objectively reasonable police officer looking at this court's precedent to date, Officer Rhodes' actions were justified. And then the third case I want to highlight is another one that this court pointed out in its prior opinion, which is United States versus Brookins from the Fourth Circuit. I fully recognize that case is not binding on this court, but it is the Court of Appeals, the Federal Court of Appeals, under which police officers in the Commonwealth have to act. And as this court pointed out, the Fourth Circuit expressly declined to adopt an interpretation of the automobile exception that would, quote, never apply when a vehicle is stationed on private residential property. So although one case, I think, would be sufficient here, and the automobile exception itself until Collins would be sufficient to take this case outside of the exclusionary rule, all of the precedent that covers the Commonwealth would suggest that Officer Rhodes' actions were just objectively reasonable at the time.
And what about exigent circumstances?
So our argument, Justice Kelsey, on exigent circumstances is, to boil it down very quickly, is that Mr. Collins is focusing too much on individual pieces of what went on in what was a complicated, fast-moving police investigation that on September the 10th that played out over the course of about an hour from the time they arrived at the DMV to the time he was arrested at his house. During that time, they learned, they had spoken, Officer McCall and Officer Rhodes had spoken together previously, had identified Mr. Collins as the suspect. They learned he was at DMV because officers were investigating a different potential stolen vehicle incident. While there, they were able to obtain Mr. Collins' Facebook page, which showed photos of the motorcycle. They showed them to him. He immediately lied about his knowledge about the motorcycle, even though it was parked directly outside of the house with a picture of the same car he was there at the DMV that day about. Collins left the DMV first, so there was a period of time in which he had departed, potentially to return home. While the officers were there, Officer Rhodes was able to determine through a different informant where the Del Meat house was. He arrived on scene. I mean, there is a dispute in the record, as Your Honors have pointed out, about whether or not Officer Rhodes knew anybody was home.
Let me ask you this. Why wouldn't he just go up to the door and knock on her and say, can I look at your motorcycle? I mean, that would determine whether there's an accident circumstance or not.
It certainly would have been, the facts would be different. I mean, why he didn't, I don't personally know. But the point is, there is a dispute in the record that I want to touch on briefly, which is whether or not he knew somebody was home. The sentence that's quoted repeatedly by my friends on the other side is from the preliminary hearing in this case. And our position is that the defendant did not put the preliminary hearing back into evidence at the suppression hearing or at trial on that point in particular. And I say on that point, if I may conclude.
Well, I think you're answering Justice Kelsey's original question. Is that correct? All right.
And so the reason that piece wasn't in the record was because they chose not to make it available. And I say on that point, because if you go back and look at the joint appendix at a variety of pages, let me see if I can grab some real quick, 208, 209, for example, there are questions asked at the trial and at the suppression hearing to impeach Officer Rhodes based on his preliminary hearing testimony. And at the suppression hearing, the defense counsel argued that there were no exigent circumstances present. So they had the opportunity, they could have put the preliminary hearing evidence in if they thought it was relevant. And it's important because the trial court here, there's about a six-month gap between the preliminary hearing and the suppression hearing, and it's asking quite a lot for the court to sua sponte know, you know, what your argument is.
Then why, under the best case scenario for the defense, would the only result they could obtain at this point is simply a remand for determining that one fairly important factual question?
I think that is the best result they could hope for, Justice Kelsey. We think that the facts as they are sufficient for exigent circumstances for the reasons given by the Court of Appeals and in our brief, and because the exclusionary rule wouldn't apply in any event, we just don't think it's necessary in this case.
But why do we need to address those larger questions before we know exactly what the fact is? Because as Justice Goodwin points out, it's pretty significant whether or not he thought there was a possibility that the man might have been in the house or could be showing up through the back door for all he knows.
So, Justice Kelsey, it's not significant with respect to the exclusionary rule because the exclusionary rule would cover the automobile exception, which would have authorized a search here.
And so,
for that reason, that's the easiest way to resolve the case from our perspective.
But it seems like to me, as far as the exigent circumstances goes, you're saying you can't win on that unless we send it back, right?
No, Your Honor, we think we can easily win. I'm just pointing out that even
Then you could lose, too. It can't be like, you know, if we win, we can win because the facts are sufficient. But if we reverse what was done before, then there has to be additional facts. We need to send it back for additional fact-finding for that.
Justice Goodwin, our position, just in case I wasn't clear, is that this court can fully resolve this case on exigent circumstances on the facts as they currently are, including if you take their statement out of the preliminary hearing, which we don't think you should do, but even if you attribute to Officer Rhodes that he knew nobody was there, for the cases cited on footnote 16 of our brief, as well as in Timms itself, which I will leave with the last point, if I may. In Timms, there was no evidence that all the people who were involved with that automobile had been arrested. And it ended up that somebody's mother was at the house, but the officer didn't go up the driveway first, did he?
Thank you very much. Mr. Gunn, there's rather robust questioning of the Commonwealth in this case, but I ask the clerk to put 3 minutes on the clock for you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Wait just a second. There you go. 3 minutes.
One more. Oh.
All right. You may proceed.
It would have been easy for the Commonwealth to assert a Davis good faith argument in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals, in this court, in the United States Supreme Court. Here, I analogize the situation that we are here now as a petition for rehearing. And essentially what the Commonwealth is arguing is every time a Fourth Amendment case comes up to this court, and this court rules against the Commonwealth, it can then say, oh, wait a second, let me file a petition for rehearing. We now have this Davis argument. That is not how...
May I interrupt you? One very quick question. Is the preliminary hearing really properly before the trial court? Was the preliminary hearing properly before us? I mean, why are we even talking about preliminary hearing when the fact finder never saw it?
Because the Commonwealth has brought us into the world of alternative grounds, Your Honor. We are not, I appreciate the principles that the Commonwealth has articulated in the general appeal. Yes, we are very concerned about what the circuit court had before it. But the circuit court here never decided and never had put before it the issue of exigent circumstances. So the Collins never sandbagged the circuit court on these facts. Instead, this is an entirely new argument brought forward on appeal. And the alternative ground standard is, does the record support the alternative ground?
But the record before the trial court, the record before the trial court was the suppression hearing evidence plus the trial evidence. And if the trial evidence came out and supported a suppression argument that could not have been made earlier, then, of course, there'd need to be either a motion to renew or to reconsider or a new motion to suppress at the time of trial. So that logic makes perfect sense. But to take the preliminary hearing testimony, which is not before the trial court at all.
Well, it was a preliminary hearing that occurred in the trial court. It is literally part of the trial court record, and I appreciate that there are different judges deciding different aspects of the trial court proceedings. And so if this was the typical appeal, if we were not in the world of alternative grounds, your point would control. But what the alternative grounds standard review is, does the trial court, this court just basically wants to make sure, what's the objective truth? Because we want to affirm on what is right. And the alternative grounds argument requires this court to consider the totality of the record, the trial court record, and so it gets to consider all the pieces to make sure it affirms on grounds that are actually correct and true. And I know there was a lot of discussion about questions in the record, there's gaps in the record. Because we're in the realm of alternative grounds, this is not the normal appeal. The appellee is not benefiting from the reasonable inferences if there are gaps, if there are conflicting inferences in the record. The proper result is to decide whether on this record exigent circumstances existed. They did not, for the four reasons I already addressed. And remand is inappropriate because, once again, an appellee of any kind does not get to argue alternative grounds and say, oh, let me go supplement the record to really show that these alternative grounds could win the day. With that, yes, Your Honor.
I just had a question as to your position concerning the application of the exclusionary rule in this instance.
So we stand by the fact that, as a matter of Virginia appellate procedure, the Commonwealth has waived that argument because it could have and should have raised Davis. But even if you say, setting waiver aside, Davis does not apply because Timms was about, at the end of the day, automobile exception in public places or on private property held open to the public. The Commonwealth never before today has asserted that Timms controlled this court, and the Court of Appeals never thought it answered the question because it doesn't. Officers, reasonable officers, will not understand Timms to say, hey, you can crawl into the home side window to investigate vehicles found inside the home.
But seven appellate judges in Virginia, not one of us said that you don't have the opportunity as the Commonwealth to use the automobile exception if you break some invisible line into a curtilage on a driveway. None of the ten of us said that.
Right, Your Honor. I believe that's actually flipping the standards. The question for Davis is whether the binding authority, so not Fourth Circuit authority, the binding appellate authority specifically authorized the actions. And here, it was an open question before.
Specifically authorized or whether it was an open question?
No, the Davis standard, the binding appellate authority has to specifically authorize the conduct. So, for example, in Byrd, you had Third Circuit appellate court saying, hey, if you find a rental car, search it, have fun. You can search the rental car without probable cause. But that was not the case here because before Collins was decided, it was an open question in Virginia whether it could be accomplished. And because it was an open question, it was not specifically authorized.
Thank you.
All right. Well, counsel, the court appreciates the well-done presentations on both sides. Thank you very much. Call the next case.